Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Father Ed Campion makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. On this occasion, the talk about John Henry Newman, who, as you all know, was beatified by the Catholic Church last year. Now, Ed Campion is well known to all of you here. He's written works on Lord Acton, on John Henry Newman, on Daniel Mannix, on Father Ted Kennedy, and books such as Rock Choppers, Australian Catholics, A Place in the City, and others. I guess he's best described as a priest-writer, or as a writer-priest, or something like that, but he's very prolific, and it's great that he could find time to come along and talk to us tonight on the topic, John Henry Newman, a Cardinal for Our Times. Ed, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Fellow legatees of John Henry Newman, I thank the Sydney Institute for this opportunity to honour John Henry Newman, as I thank you for joining me in honouring him. When John Henry Newman died in August 1890, among the many, many obituaries, including one in the Sydney Bulletin, perhaps the most remarkable was in the London Anglican weekly, The Guardian. It was written, we now know, by the Dean of St Paul's Cathedral, London, Richard William Church. Church had been a disciple of Newman's at Oriel College, Oxford, and then in the depressed year of 1846, had founded The Guardian to keep Newman's vision alive in the church he had just abandoned, and who had in recent years written, but not yet published, that classic of religious historiography, The Oxford Movement, 1833 to 1845. Written it after consultation with Newman, who sometimes stayed with him in London, where the old man much enjoyed the company of Dean Church's daughters, who were astonished to find that their father's clever friend hadn't read a favourite book of theirs, so they sent him Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and later The Hunting of the Snark, both by Lewis Carroll. Well then, this is how the Dean of St Paul's began his obituary of the Cardinal Deacon of St Giorgio in Bolabro. Cardinal Newman is dead, and we lose in him not only one of the very greatest masters of English style, not only a man of singular purity and beauty of character, not only an eminent example of personal sanctity, but the founder, we may almost say, of the Church of England as we see it. The founder, we may almost say, of the Church of England as we see it. It's a startling claim. If an Anglican were writing about Newman today, I wonder would he or she borrow R.W. Church's words without qualifying them somewhat? For that matter, what would a Catholic writer say of Newman today? Perhaps reaching for an epithet, as obituarists are wont to do, he might borrow phrases that are often heard, such as the father of Vatican II, or Vatican II, Newman's Council, or the 20th century, Newman's Hour. Perhaps such epithets claim too much, and in any case are difficult to substantiate. Yet, as Pope Paul VI said of him, many of Newman's central concerns continue to have contemporary relevance. Across the gap of two centuries, he speaks to us in ways that still make sense. Take, as an example, the narrative of his journey from being an Anglican to being a Catholic. He was brought up, he tells us in Apologia Pro Vita Sua, to take great delight in reading the Bible, and this never left him. As a young don at Oxford, he added to this by beginning to a systematic reading of the earliest Christian writers known as the Fathers, starting with Ignatius of Antioch, that celebrant of episcopacy. You see, he wanted to believe that the Church of England was the linear descendant of the Church of the Fathers. And you might say that what he and his friends in the Oxford movement were trying to do was to re-establish in England the Church of the Fathers, the primitive church. Fasting, feast days, liturgy, penances, celibacy, belief in miracles, and devotion to the saints. Looking back on his years as an Anglican, he would write in 1871, "I was always asking myself, what would the fathers have done? What would those whose works were around my room, whose names were ever meeting my eyes, whose authority was influencing my judgment, what would these men have said? How would they have acted in my position? I'd made a good case on paper. What judgment would be passed on it by Athanasius, Basil, Gregory, Hilary, or Ambrose?" No wonder that when he came back into his room at Littlemore, after making his submission to Rome at the feet of Father Dominic Barbary on the 9th of October, 1845, no wonder he took the Benedictine patristic folios down from his shelves, held them in his arms and wept over them. "You are all mine now." Why did he do it? Much later, when photography was in vogue, he would hit upon the image that doing church history is like turning the pages of a family photograph album. Century by century, you can see the family face passing through the generations. And that face, he had come to realise, was not an Anglican face. Another way of putting this is to say, if Athanasius, Basil, Gregory, Hilary or Ambrose came to London, where do you think they'd worship? It's a powerful argument, and it works through the imagination, not primarily through the reason. You see, like Pascal, Newman knew that in life matters, change happens through the imagination more than through the reason. Reason, yes, if you're doing science or mathematics, but not if you're about falling in love or changing your church. Not that those life decisions are irrational, but their motor power comes from the imagination. He once wrote in a letter to the Times, "The heart is commonly reached through the reason, not through the reason, but through the imagination, by means of direct impressions, by the testimony of facts and events, by history, by description. Persons influence us, voices melt us, looks subdue us, deeds inflame us." So no one argued John Henry Newman into the church. "Catholics didn't make us Catholics," he once said. "Oxford made us Catholics." Indeed, while he was wrestling with his soul, he kept away from Catholics. Oh, there's an exception to this I want to mention. Charles Russell spent most of his priestly life at Maynooth, the National Seminary of Ireland, where he was the professor of church history and then became its president. He wrote many articles for the Dublin Review and several books and is today quite forgotten. He deserves to be remembered. Here's what Newman wrote about him at the end of the Apologia. "He had, perhaps, more to do with my conversion than anyone else. He called upon me in passing through Oxford in the summer of 1841, and I think I took him over some of the buildings of the university. He called again another summer on his way from Dublin to London. I don't recollect that he said a word on the subject of religion on either occasion. He sent me at different times several letters. He was always gentle, mild, unobtrusive, uncontroversial. He let me alone." So, when John Henry Newman moved finally, he did so on the dictates of his conscience, not in submission to anyone's argumentation. But there was a price to pay for following one's conscience. Later he would say that losing his friends after the decision of 1845 was the thing that cost him most. Indeed, in the 2 years before that decision, as he tossed and turned, the prospect of his loss seems to have brought him close to a nervous breakdown. The heart, he would say, the heart bears the scars of wounds as much as the body. You can see the continuing pain all through the volumes of his letters. And if you look at the apologia, at the dedication of the apologia on its final page, you'll see the same thing. His Anglican memories heavy with sentiment, the Catholic experience spare and straitened. An enemy once said of the Irish statesman Eamon de Valera that all his life he wrestled with his conscience, and he always won. Of John Henry Newman, you might say that he wrestled with his conscience and he always lost. So when, throughout his life, following one's conscience became an issue, he knew from his own experience that there was a price to pay. And that's why he wouldn't hurry people into the church. They must consider the price. His enemies thought he was perhaps dissuading people when he was really cautioning them to be aware of consequences. That said, he was adamant that conscience must be obeyed because it was the voice of God. So central was this to his thinking that he made the existence of conscience a proof of the existence of God. Everyone, he would say, has a conscience that tells him or her about right and wrong. It's not produced by society or breeding or family. No, it's innate, inherent, as natural as our digestion. How is it there? Its only explanation is God, who speaks to us about our duty in our conscience. Newman once wrote that in Christian tradition, that is, Anglicans, Wesleyans, Presbyterians and others, as well as Catholics, conscience means the voice of God in the nature and heart of man as distinct from the voice of revelation. It means a principle planted within us before we have had any training, although training and experience are necessary for its strength, growth and due formulation. Conscience, he says all Christians agree, conscience is the internal witness of both the existence and the law of God. Faced with making a decision about a particular course of action, Newman says he would see what theologians could do for me, what the bishops and clergy around me, what my confessor, what friends whom I revered. And if, after all that, he found he couldn't take their view on the matter, then I must rule myself by my own judgment and by my own conscience. Now, whenever I recall this teaching of Newman's, I see Catholic people nodding their heads. Yes, yes, they seem to say, we know that. That's church teaching as we've known it all our lives. Well, certainly since that Vatican II Declaration on Religious Liberty, Dignitatis Humanae. But it was not always thus. The first Catholic bishop Newman knew, Cardinal Wiseman, once wrote this: "The Church does indeed often want your zealous cooperation, your social influence, your learned or ready pen, your skillful pencil, your brilliant talents, your weighty name, your abundant means. But the direction, the rule, belongs to us. We will call you forth when the Church of God wants your aid. We will always gladly see you working with us, but we cannot permit you to lead where religious interests are concerned." Cardinal Wiseman. Not much room for individual conscience or personal responsibility there. In Cardinal Wiseman's clericalist model of the church, the laity had only to follow their leaders. It was my way or the highway. What is the province of the laity? The Pope's friend Monsignor Talbot wrote to Archbishop Manning. What is the province of the laity to hunt, to shoot, to entertain? These matters they understand, but to meddle in ecclesiastical matters they have no right at all. What a contrast with John Henry Newman. You see, the Oxford movement had been a collaborative effort between clergy and laity, and Newman hoped to see something similar in his new church. When, in the early 1850s, the Irish bishops invited him over to start a university, he thought his providential moment had come. Perhaps this was the great mission God had intended for him in his Catholic years, a Catholic university for the English-speaking world. A university, he knew, wasn't a seminary. It was not a seminary, not a teacher's college, not a college, a school of nursing. The university was to produce men of the world for the world, Catholic laymen who were equipped to pursue their own vocations. Alas, it was not to be. The Irish bishops, led by Cardinal Cullen, whose nephews as bishops brought his clericalist vision to Australia, the Irish bishops wanted a subservient, docile laity in a priest-ridden church. By 1858, Newman had had enough. He resigned and never in his long life went back to Ireland. The idea of a university, his programmatic lectures, were allowed to stay in print. 400 copies of the first edition, by the way, came to Australia, influencing our neonatal universities and remaining on the shelves to tease anyone brave enough to engage in tertiary education today or to run an inquiry into universities. But after his experience of Ireland, and as he got to know English Catholic bishops, he came to see that a Catholic university in the 19th century would be an impossibility. The bishops, whose experience of higher education was mainly in Roman seminaries, wouldn't allow a true university to happen. By 1872, he was writing, "I should not propose a Catholic university, for I think our rulers, that is the bishops, wouldn't give us a real one." Newman turned to other things. His experience of undergraduates in Dublin revealed deficiencies in Catholic schools, and now Catholic parents, particularly converts, wanted to send their boys to Oxford and Cambridge, and who would prepare them? They petitioned Newman to start a school. Might it not be a Catholic Eton without the physical thuggery of English public schools nor the spying and tale-bearing of Catholic colleges? So at the behest of the laity, he commenced the Oratory School. The noticeable thing about its culture was that it stayed a lay project. He insisted that the laity remain engaged in the school, refusing to fill in when they were slow to respond to needs. Well, as you may know, sending Catholic boys to open universities such as Oxford and Cambridge would be banned while Cardinal Manning was alive. Manning and the Vatican kept Catholics out of the universities to maintain control over their minds. An educated laity open to the liberal currents of national culture would threaten clerical control. Newman wrote, "The Archbishop considers only an ignorant laity to be manageable." The same mindset had blocked a free press for English Catholics, and perhaps you know this story well too. In 1858, the young Sir John Acton returned to England from his studies abroad, studies that would lead at the end of his life to his appointment as the Regius Professor of Modern History at Cambridge, and the first Catholic to hold a chair there in 300 years. Now, in 1858, Acton teamed up with a sharp convert clergyman, Richard Simpson, who I can't forbear to mention has written the standard life of St. Edmund Campion. Acton and Simpson set to with youthful vigour that was noticed by men such as Matthew Arnold, Mr. Gladstone. What they wrote, however, and the way they wrote it, was unpalatable to the bishops. The Rambler, for instance, discussed educational questions, which the bishops considered closed to lay discussion. So the bishops moved to censure the Rambler. Now, reading the Rambler sometimes set Newman's teeth on edge, but to keep the magazine alive as a safety valve, as he said, he now agreed to take over the editorship. Well, writing about the educational question, he observed that, of course, the hierarchy was interested in hearing from lay people, whose children, after all, were the ones in school. And to clinch the point, he remarked, by the way, that recently the laity had been consulted in the definition of a dogma, the dogma of the Immaculate Conception in 1854. Consult lay Catholics about a dogma? Was this a heresy? It certainly gave offence to watching heresy hunters. To cover his tracks, Newman now produced a long article on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine. In the history of theology, this is a landmark, a foundational document in modern ecclesiology that leads straight to the Vatican II teaching on the Church, just as his other writings on conscience lead straight to Vatican II on freedom of conscience. But in 1859, it horrified the heresy hunters, and Newman lost the editorship, retiring into gloom and despondency. And in time, Acton changed the Rambler into the Home and Foreign Review until it too fell in 1864, the year of the anti-liberal Syllabus of Errors. Well, it's a sad story. But it gives us one good cameo. When William Bernard Ullathorne, Bishop of Birmingham, visited Newman to persuade him out of the editorship, he remarked, "Well, after all, who are the laity?" To which Newman replied, "The church would look foolish without them." This cameo of Newman's pointed reply to Ullathorne is one I treasure. Another comes from a letter from Acton to Simpson. In the early days of the magazine, when its first troubles were brewing, Acton went to Birmingham to see Newman. On that cold December afternoon, as they sat for 3 hours over the fire while Acton poured out his troubles, Newman, rocking back and forth, Acton said, like an old woman with the toothache, and surprising the young baronet with his sympathy for their cause. "He complained about the ignorance of their would-be theologians," said Acton, "and the natural inclination of men in power to tyrannise." Now there's an idea that Acton squirreled away in his memory. Years later, as you know, he would polish it into a pungent phrase: power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. Newman kept using the words tyrant and tyrannise in these years as the decade darkened down towards its denouement in the Vatican I Infallibility Decree. In his 60s, he often thought about his own death. He would in fact live until his 90th year. After the debacle of the Rambler, he stopped writing for publication. Under a cloud in Rome, and out of favour at home, he decided to remain silent. He still wrote. Oh yes, Newman without a pen in his hand is unimaginable. What he wrote were letters, as many as 20 in a day. They're now collected in 32 thick volumes, the last three of them edited by an Australian Mara's brother, her brother Frank McGrath. Newman's letters are a primary source for the story of his life. "A man's life lies in his letters," he wrote more than once. He shared with Acton the view that the only authentic biographies were collections of letters strung together with a minimum of explanatory text. A view that in an age, as you know, in an age of emails and text messages and phone calls, hasn't stood the test of time. I speak as the biographer of Ted Kennedy of Redfern, who's never off the telephone, and who wrote only public letters for public consumption. There's nothing else there. Newman's letters take us behind the scenes, as it were, of the great public dramas of his life. They tell us what he was really thinking, really feeling. There's the letter to Emily Bowles, marked most private, criticising the Roman authorities. His snub to Monsignor Talbot, who wanted him to preach to a more select congregation in Rome than he would find in Birmingham. Birmingham people have souls, wrote back Newman. His fierce complaint against the scheming Henry Edward Manning. His letter to Gerard Manley Hopkins, siding with the Irish against the English occupation. His protest against Catholic conservatives at the time of Vatican I, an aggressive, insolent faction, he called them. And his exemplary rebuke of his sometime disciple, John Walter, proprietor of the Times, for his anti-Catholic bigotry. Other letters tell you about the private, domestic Newman, worrying about the butcher's bills, troubled incessantly with toothache, attending a children's party, putting in a shower bath and using it five times a week, sending nonsense verse to a girl who baked him a cake, and another letter to a girl who made him some pen wipers, writing hymns while shaving in the morning, laughing in bed about an Anthony Trollope novel, and then waking up and laughing again, and a constant nightmare that he was back in Oxford, about to preach a university sermon, and nothing prepared. So the letters are a window into the quotidian John Henry Newman, going about his duties in the Oratorian parish in Birmingham, as well as being a record of his pastoral care of the many people from all over the place who consulted him in the stressful years of the Syllabus of Errors and the Infallibility Decree. He said Mass, he heard confessions, he visited his parishioners, and he preached. Newman's Anglican sermons have always attracted attention. Undergraduates packed into St. Mary's Church at Oxford to hear them, and remembered them all their lives and quoted them. Dean Church said that while men were reading and discussing the tracts for the Times, they were learning the living meaning of their faith in those sermons. The wisest of church historians, Owen Chadwick, in his little book on Newman, the best short book on him in my estimation, now back in print, Owen Chadwick says that the Anglican sermons were the most important publication, not only of his Protestant days, but of his life. What a challenging judgment from someone like Chadwick. At Oxford, Newman read his sermons. That is, he wrote them out and simply read them to an attentive audience, a congregation. You're an audience, they're a congregation. Which is, and that's why we have eight volumes of the parochial and plain sermons, as he called them, when he published them all together. Now, when he became a Catholic, he observed that Catholic priests didn't read from a prepared text. So he adopted their practice, which is why, apart from some special occasion preaching, such as the Second Spring, a sermon preached at the First Synod of the Restored Catholic Hierarchy in 1852, we have none of his Birmingham parish sermons. What he did in Birmingham was to mount the pulpit with Bible in hand and speak directly to the people, turning the pages of the Bible and reading texts to them. People remembered how reverently he read our Lord's very words. And afterwards he would go up to his room and write down his line of thought as he developed it in the pulpit. At Sunday High Mass, he took his turn with the other fathers of the oratory in giving the sermon. It was their custom to limit the duration of a sermon. So a boy from the school would sit with a watch and a bell And when time was up, he would ring the bell, even if the preacher were John Henry Newman. And Newman would stop. One of the great preachers of the 19th century England, rung off by a schoolboy. Amazing. Even when he became a cardinal, he continued to preach at parish masses as his turn came round. But within a few years, as he moved into his 80s, he began to complain that he sometimes forgot what he was going to say. So he dug out the manuscripts of his Oxford sermons, he still had them, and took them into the pulpit and read them to a new audience. By the way, I think this is evidence of Newman's remarkable continuity of mind. A century earlier, Dr. Johnson had said that a man who goes from Protestantism to Popery loses nothing, he adds to what he already has. And this was certainly true of Newman. His mind before 1845 and after 1845 remained the same, but it went on growing as it reached out and assimilated new material. It was, however, the same mind, which is why from the 1860s on, he brought back into print the books he'd written as a young Anglican, such as the sermons. Throughout this lecture, I've been making glancing references to Newman's difficulties with those in authority in the church. There was Cardinal Wiseman, who wrote an article on a paedophile friar, Friar Giovanni Achilli of Malta, which Newman used in a mordant lecture that led him to being charged with criminal libel. Would Wiseman help with his defence? Certainly, certainly. But the letters Wiseman wrote to continental authorities were too weak to be of any use, and the documents he'd promised never turned up, and Newman lost the case. Then there was the scheme for a new translation of the Bible with Newman as its principal. It was proposed by the bishops, and so Newman set to gathering a library and choosing his collaborators, until the American bishops got to hear of it and wrote to Wiseman suggesting that Newman work with them on a translation they were doing. Wiseman sent the letter on to Newman and never mentioned it again. So the Newman translation died of inanition, and it was buried in the cardinal's silence. Worse, at the time of the Consulting the Faithful article in the Rambler, when Newman was under investigation in Rome, his letter of explanation was lost by Wiseman and never presented to Rome. Newman learnt not to trust Cardinal Wiseman. Then there was Cardinal Cullen in Dublin, who kept his own counsel, wrapping himself in silence, neither replying to Newman's letters about the university nor speaking to him about it. The cardinal wanted a servant, not a collaborator. As for Newman's relations with Henry Edward Manning, they're sufficiently well known, I think, to need much exploration here. Manning came to see Newman with his trust in the laity and his schemes for their advancement as the most dangerous man in England. The phrase is Talbot's, with whom Manning agreed. Manning's nephew was in the Birmingham Oratory, Henry Ignatius Dudley Ryder. See, Manning's wife and Ryder's mother had been sisters. Well, Father Ryder, hit upon a brilliant military metaphor when he saw his uncle, the Cardinal, as a forceful major general deploying God's army, and hence being punitive against anyone who didn't fall in with his battle plans, as Newman certainly didn't. By the mid-1860s, the two best-known converts from the Oxford movement were enemies. "I cannot trust the Archbishop," Newman wrote. "He would have to go through the fires of purgatory before I trust him again." A sad story. Well, as Dom Cuthbert Butler of Downside Abbey once wrote, church history is often the story of quarrels. Good men. Newman, being Newman, tried to win some meaning out of his experience of episcopal power. He never allowed his difficulties to dilute his duty of obedience. God forbid that I should liken them to the scribes and Pharisees, but still I obey them as scribes and Pharisees were to be obeyed, as God's representatives, not from devotion to them. Still, he was human. And in his private journal, to which he committed his most intimate thoughts, he wrote, years 1867, "The iron has entered my soul. I mean that confidence in any superiors whatever never can blossom again within me." His harsh experience, he had written an early entry in the private journal, "has made me feel that in the Blessed Sacrament is my great consolation, and that while I have him who lives in the church, the separate members of the church, my superiors, though they may claim my obedience, have no claim on my admiration and offer nothing to my inward trust." So this is the iron theology of power that Newman wrought in the furnace of actual church life. The often cruel reality of authority is a special tax God places on Catholics for having the benefits of that authority, such as the Mass and sacraments. As he wrote, "Where you have power, you will have the abuse of power. And the more absolute, the stronger, the more sacred the power, the greater and more certain will be its abuse. The treasure we know is in earthly vessels. While men are men, spiritual power will have terrible abuses. It is the price we pay for its benefits." Years ago, in Acton's papers at Cambridge, I came across a note for a lecture he was preparing on Erasmus. Acton wrote of Erasmus, "He did not despair of the church." Well, the same could be said of John Henry Newman. He did not despair of the church. And now we can say the church hasn't despaired of John Henry Newman. It set him on the path to canonisation.
Many thanks, Father Campos. We've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. Just wanted to lead off you made a reference there. I mean, as you well know, the two famous converts of the 19th century were Cardinal Newman and Cardinal Manning, and you've spoken, and of course Manning had been married and Newman, of course, wasn't. But there is a kind of difference between the two of them, and there's been a recent biography out on Cardinal Manning, and it makes this point, that Newman got a lot of praise from the intelligentsia because he gave wonderful sermons and he wrote beautiful material and he was a great thinker. Manning, on the other hand, hasn't had such a good press in recent times, but he did an awful lot for the poor in London, for the working class, for educating not only Catholics but poor people generally in the vicinity of London where he had his role. What was the nature of the tension between the two? Was it between a practical man and an intellectual, or was it beyond that?
Yes, I'm glad you said that about Henry Edward Manning. He had a very strong social sense. He was a supporter of trade unions, for instance. His portrait used to hang in the trades hall at Ballarat. He got on well with working men because they knew he understood them. When it came to church matters, he was typical of many of the Oxford movement people. He thought that the answer to everything lay in Rome. And Newman didn't think that, and I think that is the main difference between them. If you take an Oxford movement spiritual writer such as F.W. Faber, his overheated hymns and his prayers and so on are very un-English. Newman used to say, "I prefer to pray as an Englishman." Manning went along with Faber, and indeed Faber and Manning were colleagues in all those matters. I think that is true. But yes, that's a good biography of Manning, just as John Cornwell's latest biography of Newman is a very good.
Yes, if you just stay here, there'll be plenty of questions. So there's one here and there's one there. Okay, don't stand up.
Yep. I do hope you don't mind me asking this question, because I don't want to be offensive. And this is something I've thought about for a number of months. But it seems to me that the strongest statement, in my mind, that Jesus Christ made in the three Gospels, whoever touches or harms the hair of a child's head should be had a millstone round his neck and be drowned in the bottom of the sea. Would that apply to sexual abuse?
Well, I think it would, yeah.
Okay. So we want to take questions on the topic of John Henry Newman.
Well,
yeah. Okay, wait, and we'll give Miss your chance. Okay. We're a ruthless authoritarian with the congregation, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what was behind the Oxford movement in the sense of its timing? Did it have something to do with the development of the Anglican Church at the time? I mean, there was a breakaway Methodist at that timing. What was the kind of central force that brought about the Oxford movement? Because it is something really special in historical time, and there must have been something happening in the Anglican Church, not just the Roman sort of attraction.
Yes.
Can I get you to talk to the end of the room?
Yep. Certainly.
Yep.
Am I doing that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Talk to your congregation.
Sure, yes.
That's right.
Yes, Anne's question was, what drove the Oxford movement? Newman always said, and historians generally follow... Newman always said that the movement really started in 1833 with a sermon that John Keble preached, and that sermon was against the activities of the British government in closing down some of the Irish seas. The Oxford movement then said the government has no right to lay hands on the church. So first it was a church movement, and it, in becoming a church movement, it went back and looked at history. You may have noticed that I said that Newman grew up with a great love of the Bible, and he had that all his life. It was the King James Bible, which he had on his desk all his life. But at Oxford, he came to think about the history of the church, and he went back and looked at the earliest centuries. And those centuries influenced him tremendously. So he and his colleagues, Pusey and Keble and Marriott and all the others, were trying to take what they regard as some of the riches of Christian life and re-establish them in the English church.
Bill Clark?
Yeah. I was intrigued by you just touched on when you were talking about Cullen and his nephew priests.
Yes.
And the influence that they were going to have on Australia. That was presumably the Irish missionary priests who were coming out here and the doctrine that they were teaching.
It's a question about the influence of Cardinal Cullen because his nephews came to Australia as bishops, weren't they?
Yes.
So just tell us about Cullen's.
You are aware that Irish cousinage is a very big, very big thing. We have cousins everywhere, right? Cullen who revived Catholicism in Ireland and brought it into its 19th century state, he sent his nephews out here as bishops. Moran in Sydney, replacing the English Benedictines. Quinn in Brisbane, Quinn in Bathurst, and so on. Not only that, many of them brought they had cousins who were nuns who came out here and founded convents. So it was very much a family. The Irish church in Australia was very much a family church in its leadership. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but I guess by extension, I was just interested to know whether there... I got the idea that you were implying that there was a particular type of regime, if you like.
Yes, yes, I'd say that.
That was peculiar to him and his... relatives that was imposed here, is that the case?
Yes, I think you could say that.
Fundamentalist sort of.
No, I wouldn't call it fundamentalist. I'd call it law. It was very strong on law. It insisted on the application of church law on questions like mixed marriages. When Cullen went back to Ireland, he'd spent his growing up years in Rome. He went back and he went out and visited a parish, and there was only one candle on the altar, and it wasn't a wax candle, in contravention of all the instructions coming from Rome. He said, imagine what it must be like elsewhere. They were very strict on law. Poling, who had been the founding bishop here, knew that, look, don't sit too closely to law. Try and get the people to get married anyway. The other thing is that with historians talk about the Irish Catholicism that was part of the Catholic Church that I grew up in, was a creation of that period of Cullen coming into the leadership of the Irish Church. Many of them were European devotions, which were hibernicised, but they became part of the Irish Church and the Irish Church culture, and that was brought here too. So two things really, I'd say, that very very fervent devotional culture and the strong application of law.
Okay, so we go here and here, but what I'm on the topic, okay?
Yeah. Thank you for your talk, which I think is one of the best talks. I've heard many good talks at the Sydney Institute, but I think it's one of the best talks which I've heard. My question is there any analogy in terms of controversy within the Sydney Catholic community, in the sense that there appears to be a division between belief in the rule of conscience and the rule of Rome? And I speak with great sympathy in that I see friends on both sides who seem to be involved in the struggle.
Is there any analogy on the question of conscience between what was happening then and what's happening now in the modern church? And I think you have to say yes.
There's a question. Hang on, there's a question here. Yeah. In other words, you're saying the arguments about Newman live on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wondered what influence Newman had on Knox and his conversion, if any.
And
was
it a conversion of
Ronald Knox?
Ronald Knox. Right.
Well, Ronald Knox was as an Anglican, was in the Oxford movement stream that survived. And, for instance, he took a vow when he preached as an Anglican in every sermon to mention the Blessed Virgin Mary. And when a bishop complained to him about this, he wrote, and I can imagine Newman saying this too, I think of her as the Queen of Heaven, my Lord. You think of her as a dead Roman Catholic. And that's the difference between us. But I can't closely answer your question, Janet.
Right,
there
we go. Ellen, Andrew.
Newman had a very strong friendships with the young and old, people of both the sexes, to a marked degree. The suggestion has been made in some court that he would buy an orientation homosexual. How would you respond to that?
The way that Cornwall has responded in his book, that the close and emotional friendship between men in the 19th century without physical contact was a very normal thing. Secondly, I'd say that in the 32 volumes of letters, which I've read twice, I can't think of any evidence of what we would regard as active homosexuality. What we would regard as active homosexuality. Now, beyond that, I think it's very hard to say with any... If you haven't got that sort of evidence, it's very hard, it seems to me, to say that this man or this woman is homosexual, although they're not doing anything about it. He certainly... Anyway, I think Cornwall is the best... Cornwall's new book is the best.
And Cornwall simply says there's no evidence, right?
That's right. But also that culturally, what was happening was perfectly... It was very understood at the time.
It was normal, yeah. Andrew.
Ed, thank you for your talk. To what extent do you think the current push for canonisation is Cardinal Newman is part of, I guess, the Vatican's reassertion of Catholicism in England, perhaps to revive, to enjoy the great status since the Elizabethan times? And do you think that it's linked in somewhat with the creation of the Anglican Ordinariate?
That's several questions there, Andrew. Yes. I think it was likely, for a long time it's been likely, that there would be a push for Newman's canonisation. At the beginning of his pontificate, John Paul II, who knew Newman's work well, berated the English bishops that they hadn't done more about it. I think partly it could be a financial thing. The English Catholic Church is a poor church by any other world standard. It's a very poor church. The current Pope was a scholar of Newman's, as were many of the Germans, and he knew his. So no surprise to me that he's pushing for it. Now, the second question. So does that answer that question? It seemed to me perfectly normal. If anyone was dragging their feet, it was the English. And there were some who really... aren't happy about the culture of canonisation, but that's another question. That's a cultural question, really. The second question is on the Ordinariate, and I'm not able to answer that because I'm not showing much interest in the Ordinariate. I assume very much that the people involved in the Ordinariate would be quoting Newman and would know Newman well, but beyond that I can't comment.
So the Ordinariate, for those of us who don't know what the Ordinariate is...
Don't read the papers. The Ordinariate is a group of Anglicans who are now dealing with the Vatican rather than with the English bishops, their own or the Roman Catholic bishops, to get a recognition from Rome which will allow them an Anglican culture within a Catholic organisation. Now, what that means, we're waiting to see. Does it mean the Book of Common Prayer? Does it mean... We used to say 50 years ago when we were in the middle of Vatican II that the aim, as far as worship went, that we wanted to pray like Anglicans and sing like Methodists.
Just... Ooh.
Are you able to say whether Cardinal Newman thought much about what he was doing leading to a fusing together or a reunion of the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church, and what would he make, having regard to what you just said? I don't know if the Ordinariate is what we read in the newspapers about this breakaway communions of the Anglican Church here that are seeking closer ties with Rome. I can't remember how they what they term themselves as, but they've got a special name, don't they? What would he make of that, and would he be wholeheartedly behind that movement?
There was a movement something like that in his time, and he was more interested in individual conversions. And as I suggested, he was slow about them, very slow. He wanted people to count the cost. He knew what it had cost him. And he wanted... Because in the 19th century, as any historian knows, there was much to-ing and fro-ing. People were coming across, going back, coming across, going back. Newman thought that was a disaster, spiritually and in every other way.
Stuart. Yeah.
As two towering figures in the Victorian era, William Gladstone, Cardinal Newman, what would you say their relationship was like?
Newman was Gladstone. I'm sorry, was closer to Manning as an Oxford. There were three Oxford men, but I remember reading. Gladstone's letters in the British Museum years ago when I was younger, and turning the pages of the letters, beautifully looked after by the British Museum, and recognising the handwriting. It was the time of that in 1874. When Gladstone had written an inflammatory pamphlet saying that the recent Vatican Council meant that Catholics couldn't be loyal Englishmen. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And, of course, it was a great stir. And people went to Newman and said, you must reply to this. And the letter I read from Newman was a wonderful, so typical of Newman. He said, I remember when you came up to Oxford. This was his weaponry of the heart was extraordinary. I remember when you came up to Oxford and I heard about you and we were watching. We knew great things were going to come. He's an undergraduate, for God's sake. We knew great things were going to come. So it pains me that I now have to enter the lists against you, but I have other responsibilities to my people. And so he produced his famous letter to the Duke of Norfolk, which most people, in fact, I suppose all historians regard as the best reply to Mr. Gladstone's work. Gladstone and Manning, I think, never got together again. I think it was too harsh a break. And I may be wrong about that. I'd be prepared to be proved wrong on that. But they were much closer. Gladstone, of course, was a no mean theologian. He was intensely interested in the theologies, you know.
Just a final question about Cardinal Newman's influence in Australia. It seemed to me that of those bishops and others in the 20th century, oddly enough, the person who seemed to most admire Newman was Archbishop Daniel Mannix in Melbourne, possibly because both of them didn't like Rome much. I mean, that's probably what they had in common. But just generally about Newman's influence, because as he did have a considerable influence on the church in England and to some extent in Ireland, but in Australia as well. How would you summarise that influence?
I'd say, first of all, universities. That his work on universities is still relevant, is still being spoken about at university conferences, although universities now are so different from the universities that Newman knew. But his is the classic statement of the liberal arts university. I'd say that the person of Newman is a growing influence as people know more about it. Now that we have the letters, people are able to follow Newman much more closely. Thirdly, I'd say this, and it goes a bit to your question, that, or perhaps the earlier one, that one of the great things about Newman, here I'm quoting Archbishop Ramsay, the late Archbishop of Canterbury, who said that the Newman was a bridge between the two communions, that he was able to point out the place of the Holy Spirit in both communions. And that is an extraordinary thing to have said about you by the Archbishop of Canterbury, although it looks back to the quotation I began with from R.W. Church. Newman never gave up his Anglican friends, and when they came back to him, he was very, very happy. And I think that's... I think that is the secret of, you mentioned, his being liked and Manning being disliked. And there's another reason for that, but we haven't got time for me to go into it, I suppose. Newman was popular because when in 64, he leaves in 45 and he's off the national radar, if I can use that phrase, and then he writes Apologia Pro Vita Sua, and people realise that he didn't hate the Anglican Church. His heart was still in the Anglican Church and in the University of Oxford and in those country vicarages. And that more than anything else, he was proud and happy to be an Englishman. People were saying later, if ever I had to describe John Bull, I'd point to John Henry Newman. Now, Manning, I think the wells were poisoned by Manning with a great accident of his biography, which he left all his papers behind. And a journalist said, C.S. Purcell, when he died, went to his executors and said, Cardinal Manning wants me to write his life. I do, is that right? Yeah, well, can I have his papers? And they say that he filled cabs with the papers that the old man had kept all his life, and filled it, and two volumes came out, 100, yes, that's right, 1,500 pages, and all the details. There, for instance, when we find in C.S. Purcell Manning being very shaky about whether Newman should become a cardinal or not, and that fed into Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians, which really poisoned the well. When I was teaching seminars on John Henry Newman, I can admit this to civilized people such as yourself. I always avoided telling my students about Lytton Strachey because I thought he was his eminent Victorians were so skillfully done that it would totally intoxicate their view of Manning and it would be unfair to Manning. And they should learn about Manning from someone other than Lytton Strachey, just as they should learn about all the other three eminent Victorians that he wrote about. And by the way, those papers of Manning's, the man who was supposed to write his life, J.E.C. Bodley, a young Oxford graduate who used to, not a Catholic, he used to call on the old cardinal after at night after parties, and he'd go into the house at Westminster and sit by the fire and tell Manning, Cardinal Manning, all the gossip of the London parties. And Manning said, oh, it's a wicked old world, isn't it? I'll tell you one more story. One night he said to Bodley, Bodley was supposed to write the book, and he was in France at the time, and C.S. got the papers. He said, just a minute. He said, from something you just said, I got the impression that you regard Dr. Newman, he always called him Dr. Newman, in the old Oxford's way, Dr. Newman as an Orthodox Catholic. And then he nominated on his fingers 10 heresies that were found in Newman's work. Okay, one last story about Manning to arrive. I don't want to paint him as totally black. When he was dying in 1892, his auxiliary bishop, Vaughan, the brother of Al Vaughan here, the second Archbishop, Roman Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, was there, and the old man on his deathbed saw that they were alone in the room, and he reached under his pillow and he pulled out a notebook and he gave it to Bishop Vaughan, and he said, you've been like a son to me. He said, these are my dear wife's prayers that she'd written out. I have said these every day of my life. I want you to have them. And they gave them to him, and then he died. Not immediately, but then he died, and Vaughan was with them. What did Vaughan do with them? The cardinal's late wife. I just learnt, on fairly good, on Shane Leslie's evidence, who was Winston Churchill's first cousin, that Vaughan slipped them into the coffin with Cardinal Manning. So he died with his wife's prayers. Isn't that nice? I think that's nice.
Well, we're right on time. It's been great to have Father Campion back at the Sydney Institute. A fascinating account of John Henry Newman, a cardinal for our times, with references to other cardinals such as Cardinal Manning and Cullen and all the others. So it's been a great night of clerical history, also social history, some political history, but a memorable night. Well done. No doubt you'll be back again in the future, but for tonight, great. Thanks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.